got everybody except Billy.
Hold on one second.
Open this meeting of the House Health and Human Services Committee, and just we had scheduled the Senate bills for this afternoon simply because by the time we posted and we have public hearings scheduled, we're still under the 24-hour rule, but talking to members of the committee, we will probably not convene the afternoon session until 1:30. A couple of our members will be in judiciary, but that will get us hopefully enough members to start and we can bring people down for votes. So that takes care of our schedule for this afternoon. I'm going to open our work session on House Bill 2859 for the purposes of referring the bill to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2859 to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs.
Representative Tomei moves House Bill 2859 be referred to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs without recommendation. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused.
Aye.
Aye.
Excused. Aye. House Bill 2859, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed and referred to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs. And I'll close the work session on 2859 and open a work session on House Bill 2189.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, good morning. House Bill 2189, we received testimony from Rocky King yesterday. He spoke not only to the bill but to the amendments. Even with our crisis yesterday afternoon, legislative council fabulously got the Dash 1 amendments out. So we have those before us. They, if you want to quickly just go through the topics that Rocky briefed us on yesterday, it delinks the FEOP benchmark from the Oregon small employer market. It removes the language that splits the funding between the group and the individual markets, changes the definition of family and health plan, changes the language referring to permanent residents, and removes fraudulent from the definition. And they are here to speak to the amendments, which the chair wants them to.
Yeah, just for the record, Rocky, I assume you've read the Dash 1s. And
Mr. Chair, I have. And for the record, my name is Rocky King, the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board.
And do the Dash 1s do everything that we had talked about doing in the amended version?
I believe they do, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask if Kelly, Aaron, did you have any comments? Nope, we're fine.
Okay. Any questions of Rocky? Okay, thank you very much. I would entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2189.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, moved the Dash 1s.
Okay. Representative Barker moves the Dash 1 amendment to House Bill 2189. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the Dash 1 amendments are approved.
And, Mr. Chair, this does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means by prior reference.
Okay. And I'll move 2189 to the floor via Ways and Means.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2189 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a subsequent referral to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. House Bill 2189, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2189 and open a work session on House Bill 2537.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, we heard House Bill 2537 yesterday. This is requiring the Department of Consumer and Business Services to approve a basic benefit health plan for small employers. Per the members' questions of the agency yesterday, they have provided you with some written testimony regarding Oregon's health insurance mandates. They were not able to attend this morning, but if we have any other questions, we can certainly submit them. Again, and also we have the Dash 2 amendments briefed us yesterday, and the bill is back before us today.
And committee, if you remember, we had a pretty good hearing on mandates earlier in the session. So I can remember that far back. So it would be the chair's intention to move the bill without the amendments. So, but I would entertain a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Tomei moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2537. Discussion.
Mr. Chair, I heard that the people, the parties involved, were negotiating on the Dash 2, something not quite like the Dash 2 amendment. And it would be nice to...
Jail?
Maybe have that happen on the Senate side.
Thank you, Chair Cruz, members of the committee. We have talked with Mr. Nelson at length, and we are looking at perhaps a compromise that might be worked out on the Senate side.
I'm sorry. When the sub-chair wants to talk, I'm willing to listen. what did I miss?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To reiterate, I indicated to the committee that we had been in discussions with Mr. Nelson about possible concessions on either side that might take place on the Senate side.
Okay. Any other discussion? Representative Anderson.
What's the chair's preference? Do you want to hold us off until some of the amendments have been formalized?
Well, due to the lateness in the session, if further discussions are going to happen, I'm willing to let those go on the Senate side. I would prefer the unamended bill and so they can continue the discussions over there and see if they can come to any resolution. We could certainly come back to conference at that point, but that would be my preference. So, we have a motion for the Dash 2 amendments on the table. Is there any further discussion? Are there any objections to the Dash 2 amendments?
Objection.
Clerk, call the roll on the Dash 2 amendments.
Representative Anderson.
Nay.
Representative
Barker. No.
Representative
Nay.
No.
Aye.
Excused? No. The dash two amendments, not having received the majority, are failed. I would entertain a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2537
to the floor.
With due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2537 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair,
Representative Tomei.
Thank you. I have very mixed feelings about this, as I think you're probably aware. My concern is that this passing this bill may have unintended consequences. It seems to me we're stepping back, that we've worked hard over the years to make sure that people, that citizens, are covered for all kinds of eventualities, and it seems like we're stepping back from that. I also know that small business owners are having trouble with their health insurance, as everybody else, and they're convinced that if there were fewer mandates, that they will be able to afford it more. We heard that the mandates raised the premiums 15%, but as I said, I'm concerned that other mandates will also be eliminated in even some of the larger programs. So I will be voting no on this.
Okay, Representative Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel the opposite. I will be voting aye, because with the increase that has been going on, I think it was 70% over the last 5 years, and we need to allow an emergency program to be formulated that will bring the cost down and will cost much less to a lot more people. I think that's the healthy move for our state.
Any other discussion? Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I feel strongly that everyone should have health care. When you're healthy, you can work, and when you're healthy, you can learn and graduate from high school. But what I'm seeing is that small businesses are dropping health care for their employees, or they're making the premiums so high that people aren't getting health insurance because they can't afford the premiums. I think this allows small businesses some flexibility so that I feel more people will have the opportunity to have some basic health care.
Further discussion? I'd just like to say that I'm probably going to declare conflict of interest on this, because passage of this bill may actually allow me to continue covering my employees and my business, where we're reaching a point where I may no longer be able to. And, I mean, you know, that is the issue from my perspective. So, seeing no further discussion, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Anderson.
Aye.
Representative
Barker. Aye.
Representative
Melton.
Aye.
Representative
Montes.
Aye.
Representative
Weston.
No. Excused. Aye. House Bill 2537, having received the constitutional majority, is declared passed, and the chair will carry. And I will close the work session on House Bill 2537 and open a work session on House Bill 2308. Sandy.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2308 came to us from the House Judiciary Committee. This was also one of the HIPAA bills that were a package. What we have before us is a dash two amendment that replaces the original bill, and the Hospital Association is here to speak to those amendments. Mr. Bishop.
Mr. Bishop.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing this morning on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in support of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2308. This issue may sound familiar to you. It involves HIPAA, and this committee passed House Bill 2305 earlier in the session, but unfortunately the bill got an amendment attached to it in the Senate that threw the measure out of compliance with HIPAA. And the whole reason for enacting the package of HIPAA bills that are House Bill 2305, 2306, 2307 and 2309, which this committee did, was to conform Oregon law to the federal law so that there would not be traps for the unwary who were trying to reconcile state and federal practices. The Senate added an amendment on a medical records fee schedule that is not compliant with HIPAA and would require that practitioners figure out when they could administer that fee schedule and when they could not. To remedy that glitch, the Dash 2 amendments will go back to HIPAA-compliant language like that that the committee previously approved. In addition, because of the Senate interest in having a fee schedule, we have included a fee schedule that is compliant with HIPAA and that will limit the amount that can be charged by health care providers for copying medical records. So in that respect, the amendments are somewhat different than what the committee considered previously, but these amendments would make Oregon law consistent with HIPAA, and we would urge the committee's approval of the Dash 2 amendments.
Questions?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mona Sanderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a patient requests their records, do they have to pay this fee?
They don't have to. They may. I mean, there's no requirement that they pay the fee. The provider is authorized to charge a fee and can decide whether or not to
whether
pay
to waive it or not.
Yeah. And my understanding is that in many cases, providers will waive those fees for the patients, although if it's a, you know, another party who's requesting the medical records, they may impose the fees.
Follow-up?
Yes.
I hear that this is very similar to what the Washington State has done. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, that's correct.
And follow-up. Do you know what OHSU charges?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I do not know what their charges are. Under HIPAA, as of April 14, charges have to be cost-based and reasonable. And so providers can only charge what is a cost-based, reasonable charge for copying medical records. That HIPAA law, which took effect last month, has changed practices in some respects, and these amendments will then conform state law to that, so that if there was a practice in the past of charging an excessive, unreasonable fee, that would be prohibited under both state and federal law.
Then why do you have to put a specific price? Why couldn't you have just said reasonable fee then, rather than 83 cents per page for the first 30 pages and 63 cents per page for each additional page?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mona Sanderson, we would have preferred the original language, which was more general and did not include a specific fee schedule. The Senate, however, believed that it was important to put a limit on fees and included it, and we're trying to accommodate their interests but make it consistent with HIPAA in doing that. So we're trying to do something that creates a balance but imposes a limit beyond which nobody can charge. But the fees still have to be reasonable and cost-based. They just can't exceed these amounts.
Do we have OHSU here?
I saw Jeff out in the hall.
We just got the amendment, so Apollo. But evidently, this is really quite a bit different from what OHSU charges, and it would be nice to see whether they could conform to this or if it would be pretty much a burden on them.
Yeah. We sent a posse out to see if we can find Mr. Gilmore.
It just seems like a better bill. I'm sorry, but I disagree with the Senate.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mona Sanderson, I do too. Unfortunately, the situation in the Senate is such that that was a requirement of the Senate for passing the bill in order to allow us to be compliant with HIPAA, we concluded that it was necessary to let the bill proceed on that basis. We would have much preferred the cleaner version that the House considered and adopted, but that was not acceptable to the Senate.
Now that you're fully prepared, Jeff, and I'm sure you were wishing that you had stepped out of the building for a minute, but you haven't. So.
Actually, I took off running.
Did you? You don't run as fast as you used to.
No.
Okay. Representative Mona Sanderson had a question about OHSU.
For the record, I'm Jeff Gilmore, representing Oregon Health Sciences.
Are you familiar with this amendment?
No.
Okay. Basically,
I've read what you're talking about, Representative Anderson, and I appreciate being invited up here. I'm at a disadvantage not knowing what the current rates are and what my employer thinks of the statutory rate of 83 cents per the first 30 pages and 63 cents per page for the additional pages. I could get you that answer within the hour if it would make it easier for you.
Okay. I just received something. I don't know if the governor's office has any information that they would want to share on this.
They aren't here either.
They're not here either. Okay.
Thank you, Jeff.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add, Gwen Dayton, who's the general counsel for the Hospital Association, happens to be in the building at another meeting, and I believe that she polled a number of hospitals, and she may have specific information, although
come on
she may
up,
not. And the fact that she's here now, at least we can ask.
Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton, I'm General Counsel for the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I understand you have questions about what OHSU currently charges for copying?
Yes. Representative Mona Sanderson is interested.
The short answer to that question is I'm not sure, because it's not a question I've directly asked them, and I don't want to misrepresent somebody what they do, and there may be those who work with OHSU directly who could give you more accurate question to, or answer the question than I could. That having been said, my understanding in general conversation, put it that way, is that the Washington model, which is expressed in the amendments you have before you, are generally consistent with what they might charge. Out of my understanding is that they certainly don't charge more than that. They may charge less than that. The Washington model is a cap, not a required charge. But just in conversations with them about the adequacy of our proposal, they indicated that met their needs. How's that for a vague answer? But I don't want to say something that's incorrect. If somebody else can give you a more precise answer, I can also see if I can find out the precise answer.
I'd also point out that this also is a cap. It sets a maximum.
You're thinking that OHSU actually charges less.
Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson, my sense, and I keep saying it in a vague way because I don't want to misrepresent, my sense is that they certainly don't charge more than this, that a copy charge at this level would allow them to charge what they need as they need to. Now, I don't know that they would charge up to this level, but that this would allow them to charge as necessary. Or it may well be, and in fact I'm virtually certain, that OHSU uses a copy service, and it may be that this is reflective of the charges their copy service imposes.
And I guess I'd point out, and to a degree I agree with Representative Mona Sanderson, that we shouldn't even have this in here. But the fact is that the Senate put it in, and this is an attempt to try to make what the Senate put in compliant. I mean, that's really all it is. So I mean, this is what we call compromise, I believe. So, is there any other questions?
Yeah, well, I would like to have maybe the governor's policy people make a comment on this.
Amazingly enough, Aaron's here, so. Thank you, folks, very much.
Good morning. For the record, Aaron Kelly Seal with the Governor's Office. Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson. We don't necessarily have a position that would be different than what you've heard this morning. I think that when we first took a look at 2305, when it came across our desk, we asked the question about why it had been changed from a reasonable fee to the fee schedule, and we'd also received some correspondence from some folks that that actually provide this service, stating that they felt like the fee schedule imposed in 2305 was unreasonable from their perspective, and they hadn't had an opportunity to comment on the fee schedule. And so we raised the question, that the legislation included in 2305, was it worth not signing simply because the fee schedule had been included, or would that later be rectified once it was noticed? And I guess what this amendment is attempting to do for 2308 is to do just that. And as I understand it, it does set a cap that's higher, and it seems to accommodate some of the concerns that were reflected in the correspondence that we received from some constituents. We did also do some research, and we found out that Workers' Comp, the Department of Consumer and Business Services, charges a lower fee, has a lower fee structure in place for their copying. And as we called OHSU, they're here, so I don't want to misrepresent, but they appear to have adopted the fee schedule that's included in this amendment. At least that's what we were told when we made the call. And so it seemed that there was a range, and that this was, in fact, on the top end of the range. And so it would seem if you had to include a fee schedule, this might be more appropriate because it would allow for folks that had a higher fee structure in place, higher level of fee structure in place than that originally included in the enrolled bill of 2305 to be implemented by other entities. And so I think we, too, would have preferred the reasonable fee. It seems like that may not be an option. I haven't talked to folks on the Senate side, and I haven't run this one by them, but that's the information we have. I don't know if that's helpful or not. It's not incredibly definitive. I apologize. But we kind of had the same conversation. Where are we, and what is this? Does this work for folks generally? So.
Yes. Thank you. So it's not requiring, I mean, any entity can determine the fee as long as it doesn't go over 83 and 63.
That's the way I understand the amendment to read.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just the cap.
Okay.
So, thank you, Aaron. Let me give you a little history of this. The bills did pass the House virtually, I think, unanimously. It went to the Senate, and an amendment was put in the Senate Judiciary Committee without really being fully vetted. And when it came back for concurrence, we were under the time crunch of HIPAA compliance, and so the decision was made at that time to go ahead and concur with the Senate amendment, so we had the HIPAA bills in place, and then to attempt to come back and do a modification, and that's what this is. So that's why this is here now.
Thank you.
So, Representative Anderson, you have a question?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just going to say that I feel comfortable with line 12, reasonable and cost-based fee. I don't think 83 and 63 cents per page tell the public a very good message. And incidentally, I would be interested in hearing from Mr. Bishop or some of the folks. I didn't hear a figure of what the hospitals might charge. I do know that when you go to a copying store, which is off the premises of the hospital or OHSU, that it's more like 25 cents, and that does include labor. So, you know, I think I feel like Representative Mona Sanderson does, that this is from some other planet.
Gwen?
Again, Chair Cruz, members of the committee, I'm Gwen Dayton. And your question, Representative Anderson, is a good one. We did some informal polling of what charges hospitals impose in working on this issue, and it is all over the board. Some of the smaller, more rural hospitals charge less. The large urban hospitals charge more. Many of the urban hospitals do charge according to the Washington model and believe that's appropriate. That's more than the smaller hospitals currently charge and would charge after something like this is adopted. But the original version of the copy charge language that was developed by the Senate Bill 104 committee, which was the committee that was charged with developing HIPAA legislation, did not include an actual fee schedule, but rather made a reference to reasonable cost-based charges. The fee schedule that's in here now is a reaction or reflection of the discussion on the Senate side imposing an actual fee schedule that, in fact, was inadequate.
Other questions? Well, so basically, according to what Representative Mona Anderson would prefer, we would delete a whole bunch of this language, wouldn't we?
Right. That's true. Mr. Spate made a good point that it's important to note that the labor charge involved in processing a copy request is independent and different than the actual paper on the copy machine. And there are significant requirements within a hospital, as I'm sure many of you know, to when you get a request for a record, you can't just say, okay, here, just put it on the machine and press start. You have to go through and take out information that might be sensitive, and there are a lot of other tasks that are involved in copying a record than just paying somebody to push the start button on the machine.
Thank you. Gwen, I appreciate that, but it seems to me that the first page is going to be the most expensive one. So I can imagine, say, $25 for one page, subsequent pages, 20 cents, 30 cents. Do you know what I mean? Because it's going to be the first page and finding the chart, going through it, mailing it, et cetera, et cetera. So the most expensive page is going to be the first one. The subsequent pages, it would seem to me, would be much less expensive.
Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei, I think that's probably true because there are upfront costs for every copy request. Again, going through the record, making sure you're only releasing what is appropriate to release. Under HIPAA, of course, we have to go through a basic minimum necessity analysis on records, making sure we're not disclosing more than is minimal and necessary to meet the purpose of the request. And all of that, you go through all of that regardless of whether the request is for a 10-page record or a 100-page record. I think that the effort is longer for a 100-page record, of course. But I think that's probably true. That's why the Washington model, not wanting to express the opinion of any Washington policymakers, but that reflects a higher charge for the first number of pages than it does for pages above a certain level.
Follow up on that?
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Having worked in a system, I, as a nurse, had been called. Now you're starting to make it a little bit clear to me. I, as a nurse, have been called in to the chart room to delete the information that would be sensitive. Mm-hmm. They needed to send the record out, and rather than a clerk trying to figure out what was the sensitive information, I had to go in. And so now it's, and then delete all that, and then make sure that you're deleting the appropriate piece, and then send it on. And, you know, this is a chart can be, and especially if you're doing progress notes, there's a lot of information there that you'd have to go page by page. So I'm now understanding the cost here. Okay. And that's AIDS, alcohol and drugs.
HIV, yeah.
Yeah.
And so following up on that point, Gwen, if I may, Mr. Chair, at the risk of prolonging our discussion here, my question was going to be who looks at these charts to make this decision about what is permitted to be produced in a records request and what isn't, and actually, taking it to its extreme, do you have attorneys looking at that, or pretty high-level people, or physicians, or people who would drive up your labor costs to make that records request happen?
Chair Cruz, Representative Dalto. It depends. Typically, in a larger hospital, the medical records department will take primary responsibility for that, and they are highly trained people in that area. As Representative Monis Anderson indicated, there are also other clinical staff that are sometimes involved in making that judgment as well. I think when you get into a smaller hospital, you probably don't have as full a medical records department, and so the responsibility may fall more strongly on the clinical staff, but it depends on the size of the hospital. But it certainly is somebody that is trained in medical records at a very minimum.
Thank you.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've beaten this to death. But just want to make one comment. My last official act of leaving the district on Monday night was to impale myself on a 2-inch bolt, and I decided not to suture and clean up the wound myself. So I went to the hospital, and I got my first dose of HIPAA, and it was about 2 or 3 pages of title insurance language that was so small you could hardly read anyway, and I saw them all over the waiting room after we left, so I'm sure they're not being read too well, and I just wanted to express my condolences to the hospital system and the doctors.
Thank you.
Gwen, what would happen? Do you have a copy of the Dash 2s?
Yes, I do. I apologize. I'm kind of multitasking. So
I understand that.
It's in my material somewhere. Yes.
I'm wondering what would happen, to speak to Representative Monis Anderson's concern. By the way, I kind of agree with her position. If we stop line 13 after the word requested and deleted the rest of that line and 14 through 21. I mean, are we creating a problem by doing that?
Right. Chair Cruz, I think the difficulty with doing that is that HIPAA, let me back up, one of the goals of the Senate Bill 104 committee when they developed HIPAA legislation was to avoid traps for the unwary in Oregon law. HIPAA expressly allows for the charges that are HIPAA expressly allows for copying charges, including the cost of labor and supplies for mm-hmm. copying. And so we need to continue to have that language, as well as language about postage charges and charges for preparing an explanation or summary of the individual's protected health information. If your question is more specifically taking out the 83 and 63 and referring instead to reasonable charges, including only the cost of, I think that you could do that. We may have problems over on the Senate side where we originally received the copy charge language as not properly responding to that issue.
And, Mr. Chair, if it means the bill not passing,
yeah. Well, I'm just trying to explore things. I guess it would be my desire to adopt the Dash 2s and move the bill. I mean, this may be the best we get at this point in time, and and hopefully it would satisfy the members of the Senate who wanted something more specific. So, thank you, Gwen. You can go back to your other task. I guess.
Thank you.
There's no further discussion. I would entertain a motion on the Dash 2. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move that we move the Dash 2 amendments into the bill.
Representative Anderson moves the Dash 2 amendment to House Bill 2308. Any discussion? Any objections? Hearing none, the Dash 2s are adopted.
I move the 2308 to the floor with the due pass with the amendments included. To the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Anderson moves House Bill 2308 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Seeing none, clerk, call the roll.
Senator Anderson?
Yes.
Senator Parker?
Aye.
Senator
Dalton?
Aye.
Senator
Monson?
Aye.
Aye.
Excused? Aye. House Bill 2308, having received their constitutional majority, is declared passed. We want to consent it.
Sure.
Representative Tomei moves that House Bill 2308 be placed on the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. And I'll close the work session on House Bill 2308. And I'm going to open an informational meeting. on by Digital Healthcare Incorporated. Gentlemen, the floor is yours.
Chairman Cruz, goodbye. Representative, for the record, my name is Adam Grad with Digital Healthcare.
And I'm John Root, and Ed Eagles will be here in just a minute, and we both represent Digital Healthcare.
I'm probably the only person today that's going to speak favorably of what HIPAA can do for your state. And I agree with most of what you've been saying. Digital Healthcare is a company that is doing preemptive coordination of benefits, automated coordination of benefits. What that means in the TPL area and cost avoidance area for Medicaid, TPL being third-party liability, collecting money that's already been spent incorrectly, claims that have been paid incorrectly, and recouping that money for the state, cost avoidance, trying to avoid paying claims incorrectly. What we are doing is preemptive coordination of benefits, where those claims will not be paid incorrectly, where there will be no need for cost avoidance because the claims will never get to the Medicaid department inappropriately. They will go to the proper person at the time of care. And what I was saying about HIPAA, I'd be the only one that would be speaking favorably of it. It is HIPAA that allows us to do this. The changes in the HIPAA law, specifically Section 1175, opens the gateways so we can go out and search all 4,000 payers at the time of service. Now, I am going to go through a PowerPoint presentation on it. Hopefully I can do it as quickly as Representative Cruz can move a committee along. I was duly impressed. The problem, this spells out the indicative problems, the problems we're having. And throughout the system, Princeton Consultants did a report on CMS that showed that 400 million lives were covered under the PBMs, the prescription cards. That's 49% larger than the U.S. population. Yet, the PBMs that they surveyed on this only held 60% of the market. So with two cards in each household, it should have only been 180 million cards. This is indicative of the problem. There's a large amount of other coverage available out there, where there's two, three, four cards that are available to a person at a time of need. You fund, we fund the error rate. Let me make one statement. When dealing with Medicaid, I'm going to be specific with Medicaid. This also branches out into the hospitals, third-party administrators, and other areas, but I'm going to focus on Medicaid, CMS, the public sector. When dealing with Medicaid, Medicaid is secondary to every other payer out there in almost all cases. So when there's other insurance available, it will almost always go to that other carrier in difference to when you're looking at Blue Cross and Blue Shield. They may cover something in the same way. It's hard to tell sometimes which one is primary. But when it comes to Medicaid, they are a very large winner in this scenario. The social issue is that there's over 4,000 payers, Medicaid being one of those payers, Medicaid for Oregon being one of those payers. There's over 4,000 payers in the United States. Each month, there's over 10 million eligibility changes in that population. There's no way for your Medicaid department to know who has changed eligibility. So the records that they're doing their current cost avoidance on became out of date the moment that they collected those records. Now, they may last for a while, but with as many eligibility changes that are happening, those records are changing constantly. There's no way to keep up with them. medical provider problem is that 46% of the patients show up at the provider's office without a medical card or without the ability to produce one. And when they do produce one, it doesn't specify what the coverage is, HMO, PPO, indemnity, what your deductibles are, all the way down the line. I don't need to educate the Oregon legislature on budget problems. You guys have a wonderful education going on this year with that. You can do one of three things to alleviate some of the budget pressures within Medicaid. Increase state taxes, cut benefits to Medicaid recipients, or increase the cost avoidance, which is the least draconian of all of them. We know four things about automated COB. No payer can do it today. There's nobody out there that can do preemptive automation coordination of benefits. We are a patented sole source product. There's nobody else out there that does what we do. And is consistent with the policy of the largest federal health plans. The OMB, Office of Management and Budget, in 1995 envisioned a centralized database of all eligibility data so that when somebody goes to the doctor, we can find out where they're covered and when. Because they knew then, as we know now, that if you have access to who is primary, who is secondary at the time of service, the claims will be paid correctly the first time. This is what HIPAA allows us to do. Pay and chase, PPL, does not work well. This is what your Medicaid department is currently doing. When a claim is paid out, it's hard to get that money back.
Explain what TPL is.
TPL is third-party liability. That's finding another payer. Representative Most Anderson is finding another payer that should have paid that claim instead of the state of Oregon.
And could I request that as you come along with letters that don't have any meaning for us, that you tell us what those are?
I would be glad to. And if I blaze by something, please ask a question.
You might want to review what PBM is for.
PBM is the pharmacy cards. My apologies. Avoidance reports are exaggerated since they're based on billed amounts, not what is actually paid. And then they do not subtract out the amount of the cost avoidance and errors. Contingency-based TPL vendors, now let me specify that the state of Oregon does their TPL in-house, but a TPL vendor is somebody who chases down those claims for you, generally abandon 80% of the claims available because it's not cost-effective. We have found that TPL vendors, third-party liability vendors, will not chase a claim that is under $1,000. And the average claim is $600. So a large amount of the claims are not being chased down by the TPL vendors. And that does not take into pharmacies. I imagine those $10, $20, and $30 pharmacy claims, that it's just not worth the money to chase those down. Data from the National COB analysis on six participating Medicaid states shows that our suspicions are correct. Third-party liability does not work. 20% of the tested Medicaid censuses have private sector coverage, which those states did not know about. CMS policy, CMS is formerly HICPA, the federal side of Medicaid, promotes the automated activities, automating the avoidance, automating anything that you can do, because they know that automation drives the cost down and keeps more money in-house because their matching funds are lost too. They want you to automate to the fullest extent. Avoiding payments, their action plan describes that avoiding payments of third-party claims is the most important thing that you can do. And you are currently doing cost avoidance, but it's with out-of-date information. The opportunity is moving from a pay and chase to the full preemption would enable Medicaid authorities to avoid the third-party liability write-off. Usually 80% of found TPL is never cashed out. And expanding that from 5% of the payers
in the United States to 100%, all 4,000 payers at the time of service. Massively expanding the claims avoidance would make sure that you do not spend money that should be paid by another carrier.
Question?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Chair, on the if you're making it, could you go back to the other slide? Yeah, on the 4,000 payers, it would avoid it would expand avoidance, but would it not also cut people off the plan?
Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, the claims that we will be, we're a switchboard. We will merely make sure the claims go to the correct place. If there is no other insurance available, those claims are going to come to the Medicaid department. But what we're going to make sure of is that Medicaid does not pay a claim that belongs to somebody else. So it wouldn't cut them off the plan. We just make sure that if there was any other way to pay that claim outside of your Medicaid department, we'd make sure as much of that bill appropriately, only what they're supposed to cover, would go to them.
Second question.
Yes.
You mentioned that there are, you know, many more claims than there are actual people, and some have four cards. You're going to be reducing it down to one person having one card? Is that
no. Chair Cruz, Representative Anderson, we would not change anything. We would merely have a centralized database of the eligibility information. A person can have as much insurance as they want. Inside of family, the husband and wife, this scenario was thrown at us last week in Washington, realistic scenario. Husband and wife, both divorced, both have jobs. The exes both have jobs, and the children of the marriages are covered under both parents' from both sides. So those children had four coverages. Well, only one of those companies is primary. So what we would do is just identify. John Smith is covered primary here, secondary here, and all the way down. And we'd make sure that it was billed appropriately to that level. Okay. We are not changing anything. We're merely identifying.
You're not really dealing with eligibility. You're dealing with priority.
Information.
Yeah.
Information. Big computers in the automated COB process don't notice how large the claim is. The current TPL vendors generally won't chase a claim under $1,000. We don't care if it's $1. We're going to identify the eligibility at the time of service and make sure that's billed appropriately, no matter the size, no matter anything about the claim, whether it be a pharmacy claim or a medical claim, whether it be $1 or $10,000. We're just going to make sure it goes to the right place. Case study on Idaho that we did. Currently costs $2 million per year, including the database management, to do their TPL and cost avoidance. Their company, that their outside vendor that handled this, only searches, and this is one of the largest in the country, only searches 73 payers out of 4,000, recovers $6 million by searching those 73 payers, and writes off known write-offs. This is one that they actually knew about. $6 to $7 million a year. By the way, these are Idaho numbers, not ours. These were provided to us from Idaho. So Idaho loses money each year because they're using the old system. And let me put this in again, that it's not that your Medicaid department is doing something wrong. This was never available before. Without HIPAA, this is not possible. So it's not that they're currently not doing this. It's not available to them right now. This is as of October 03 is when this starts. With DHI's automation, Idaho's cost would be $1.2 million. Then just of what we're looking at there, we would collect that whole $12 to $13 million. Excuse me, wouldn't collect. It would never leave the checkbook. We would avoid it up front. Expands the results to 4,000 payers. Our actual projected savings for the state of Idaho is $40 million. Now, they're much smaller than Oregon. Your numbers are much more substantial than that. But they're very excited about that. Currently in the RFI process, request for information process with the state of Idaho. This is the national COB cost analysis. We went out and went to ACS, They handle six, actually they handle nine, but we used six of their Medicaid authorities and went through an audited study on what the other coverage was available. The study was done by Hauser and Taylor. They stopped checking our accuracy at 0.02%. It's not that that's where we ended up. That's just where they stopped checking. We surpassed that. These are different Medicaid authorities. Here's TennCare. We found that 35% of the population of TennCare had other coverage somewhere else. 35%. This is March, June, September, 3 months in a row.
What's TennCare?
TennCare, Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei, that's Tennessee's Medicaid.
Thank you.
Here is Massachusetts Department of Massachusetts Medicaid. 21% other coverage outside of the Medicaid department. That's 21% of the people where the claim should have been paid by somebody else. Iowa, 24% consistently. Here is, and this is another area that we work with. This would be the employees plan, the state employees plan for the state of Pennsylvania. We found within that population 17% of the population had coverage elsewhere. Providence Health System. This is a hospital system that during these months, 18.65% of the admitted population had coverage other than where was billed. So remember how I said that 46% of the people come in without a card? This is the result of that they billed the wrong person 46% of the time. That increases the rescission rate for the hospital, and then they have to go chase down who is that insurance actually with, was that person fraudulent, where should that insurance go? Raises the cost for the hospital systems tremendously. So leadership out of the state will help the hospitals and providers. I don't know if you guys have heard of the Cleveland Clinic Foundation, one of the largest freestanding hospital systems in the country, on par with the Mayo Clinic. This is a letter from them, and it's included in your package. The statement from the administrative director, just his comment was, this is a quantum leap over the current best practice available to them now for admitting. Social duty is that with HIPAA compliance coming online, the hospitals are expending a tremendous amount of money right now trying to be HIPAA compliant. You were just talking about HIPAA compliance. It is not an easy subject. They don't know what to do in a lot of cases. We will eliminate a large portion of their HIPAA compliance, but they're looking for leadership from the state to know which direction to go. Representative Anderson, your incident with your self-inflicted wounds. If you were hopefully they're self-inflicted, not by somebody else. If you were to walk into that hospital, now this is a option within our system. We've outsourced with Uniscan. Doesn't say it on here, with a scanning company to provide us with a thumbprint scanner. This would take a fingerprint and turn it into an algorithm to where if you were in the system, you would merely have to walk in, put your finger on that scanner. We would know who you are, where your coverage was, what your coverage breakdown was in a moment. No more MSP questionnaires, no more lengthy questionnaires. Again, this is an option. We don't want to be Big Brother. But it's a wonderful option available. If you were to come in unconscious with no identification on you, they could identify you immediately. Here's the HIPAA. Here's the section of HIPAA that we refer to. Section 1175. The health plans may not delay. The health plans may not deny any request for information. Representative Anderson, when you went in for care, if that provider typed into your name to our system, it would go out to all 4,000 payers at that time. All 4,000 payers would be queried. They'd have to respond back. I say that this is done in a Google time. We've all done searches on Google on the Internet, typed in some obscure phrase, and come back with 10,000 references inside of 2 seconds. We're going to be using much more specific information targeted to very specific servers. It will be as quick or quicker than searching something on Google. and we will know where you're covered, what your coverage is at the time of service, and then that provider will know who to bill. So they will not shotgun bill, which is a current practice. They will not misbill and get a rescission. It will eliminate a tremendous amount of fraud. It will eliminate a tremendous amount of wasted time, effort, and money for the providers, and will cut down on the number of bills that Medicaid pays because you are secondary. Just a very rough explanation of how our system works. The 834 data at the top would be your eligibility data. That would be the Medicaid department's eligibility data being poured into the green box, our servers. Our clients within that, we would have all that information stored. When that red cross over on the side, the provider, requests information from us, the information comes into our servers. We query all our information. Whether we find something or not, these blue boxes on the side are the people, the payers that are not currently contracted with us. Because of HIPAA, we will then query all of them, whether it be 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 of them, and find out from them where that person is covered. So all 4,000 payers, whether they're inside our system or not, will be queried. The information will come back, be sent out to the provider. Here is where Representative Anderson is covered. Here's what his coverage is all the way down the line. The rest of the arrows going in and out are billing information. We can take care of it all the way down to the prompt pay penalties. If Aetna is not paying quickly enough for that provider, we can add the prompt pay penalties in and take care of that for them, too.
But question?
Yes, Representative Morris Anderson.
Thank you. In identifying a patient, people have same names, different names. Do you go with Social Security number? Do you go with what? How do you identify a person if a person is a claim is submitted from somebody and you need to figure out who the payers are for that?
Excellent question. Chairman Cruz, Representative Morris Anderson. What we use is a three identifier match. We can use many identifiers, but we principally work off four: name, address, Social Security number, DOB. We don't have to use Social Security number. There are some states that are hesitant to use Social Security number. So we're left with the last three: name, address, DOB. With those three, we can take it down and find out where that coverage is.
A follow-up? Isn't there a problem, though, especially with Hispanic names? Sometimes they'll use one name. In some circumstance, we've had them come in to our clinic. And I'm just wondering, I think that there would be some problems with names, but you haven't found that?
Chairman Cruz, Representative Morris Anderson. There will always be problems. Those problems are currently ongoing. But the eligibility data within the system is what the eligibility data is. If that person's eligibility is listed under a certain name and he doesn't give that name coming in, that's where that fingerprint ID would be very nice.
Yeah.
But that's a current problem that I don't have an exact answer for you. But with the information given, it's the old garbage in, garbage out. But if they put in an incorrect name and we come up with nothing, no coverage for that individual, they might want to try another name. But that is where the fraud aspect and the thumbprint scanner would cut down on fraud.
And follow up, firewalls for confidentiality, particularly those, I'm thinking more of those children who need to be protected from.
Very good.
Follow up.
Chairman Cruz, Representative Moines Anderson, this is not an internet-based product. This is a direct line going through the fixed lines, not out on the internet. So a server would communicate with one of our servers, and when that server contacts our server, it will have to have a certain identifier to get into our server. So it's not something that somebody can just break into and query or hack into the internet. It's a direct hard line to our servers. The information that is put in and out of the system can be done over the internet if they wish to do it that way. But for claims query and eligibility, that would all be hardwired.
Representative Tomei.
Yes. States have this program now.
Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei. Currently, it's not available because until October of this year, the eligibility data gateways will not be opened. But we have had lengthy conversations with Senator Representative Hobson. I can't remember which side he's on. He is the gentleman who wrote HIPAA. He's the one that cursed us all. He has specified very clearly that there will be no more delays, but there was one extension for the eligibility gateways. And at that time, we had our system up and running, and everything was ready to go. And because they got that waiver, everybody said, not right now. So for the October date, he has guaranteed us that there will be no more. Because they understand, the federal government understands how much money they are losing.
Okay, I'm still not clear.
I'm sorry.
So you're saying there no states as yet are using this program?
No, no states.
And do you have any states who are going to be starting the program in the fall?
We have an RFI out with Idaho. We've got very
RFI,
good requests for information.
Thank you.
The next stage of that would be request for proposal. In their RFI, it was a June RFI, and we're supposed to go to the RFP by September, request for proposal by September, providing everything goes smoothly.
Okay.
I'm in the West, so there are other states that we are working with, but they're all in the early stages, such as Oregon.
Okay, thank you.
Where's your company based?
Cleveland, Ohio. So a letter from HP and a letter from MCI, both of them included in your packages. MCI would be those hardwired fiber optic lines that we'd be using. And HP would be the servers that we're using. As I said, we've had this up and running. They are extremely confident with what we can do. There's no doubt about the technology. The technology, when you look at the internet and what we can do there, the technology is the easy part of this. Getting people, getting individuals to step into the next stage of eligibility is the hard part. Here's the server. I think the only thing out of this that I really like to bring up is down in the red section. Can do the entire COB routing, the entire annual claims of the United States of America, this one computer can do in 23 hours. And these will be, there'll be multiple stations of this around the country. So there will not be one server in case something goes wrong. These are all online servers. Anything goes wrong within this, whether it be a CPU or a power source or anything, can be changed while running. So these are the same. This is the same product that NASDAQ uses, the ATMs use, NORAD, very top-of-the-line servers. What's required to move forward is a formal agreement, two letters. One, notifying the providers that DHI is now the inbox for your claims. And then system integration and steps, we need your eligibility data, eligibility and plan structure, and then payers notice to provide the billing traffic and create a loop for those clinics that are still using paper. We have a complete scanning department that can take care of paper claims.
Question?
Yeah, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. So how much do you charge then for this service?
The fee would be 75 cents per insured per month. I'll use the state of Idaho as an example. In Idaho, they're currently paying $1.28 per insured per month for TPL and cost avoidance and for a very poor job of it. And when we thought they were paying 78 cents, so we priced underneath, they came back to us and said, no, we're paying $1.28. So the cost is far lower than what most states are paying right now for the service. Here is our projections on what the state of Oregon can save. These are on 2001 numbers. Currently with 418,000 members in your insured population. We're projecting a savings on the state side of $225 million. That's based on a 20% COB rate.
Per year?
Per year. That's on the state funding side. On the federal side, $340 million.
So this is after we pay the 75 cents per insured per month?
Correct.
Thank you.
So if that money's left inside of Medicaid and not moved out, it can relieve some of the budget pressures within Medicaid. That is the end of what I have to say. I remit the rest of my time to the committee for questions.
Questions?
We like questions.
I'll just give you the history of this. This was this presentation was made with discussions in Senator Fisher's committee. A bill was drafted there that got caught up in some totally unrelated issues, which happens in this building from time to time. I'm personally very interested in this. I think this is something that, since we will be able to do too, we should be able to go to this. Currently, we don't have the technical capabilities inside of state government to do this, and so it would make sense to outsource it rather than buy a whole bunch of new computers necessarily. So we are in the process right now of taking the good work that Senator Fisher did and putting it into a House bill for our
this session
for our consideration. So, and basically what it does is it sets up a work group to do the study to find out if we should do this. So, so hopefully that will be coming back to us next week in the form of a bill for our consideration. But I thought these folks were in town. I thought it would be good to give you folks kind of the upfront briefing of what this program is. I think I've pretty much covered it, haven't I? So, yeah, Representative Tomei.
Thank you. Can you tell me where on this sheet your expenses, what would be paid out to you?
If you see it, Ed, let me know.
Mr. Chair, if we do it just through a work study group, there's really no chance for this to happen for 2 years.
No, actually there is. What the bill will do, and I'm trying to do this from memory at this point in time, is it gives the department the authority to contract for these services, and then it sets up a work group to study the feasibility. There are dates certain in this. Our goal would be to try to have this ready to go by October.
And the e-board then would fund it? Or how would the funding come? Or it would be set up for funding if the work group authorizes it?
Yeah. Actually, based on their performance, the amount that is put out for the service would be much smaller than the amount that's saved. So it's kind of it's self-funding to a degree. So,
Representative Cruz, Representative Tomei. It's done in kind of an odd way because most states were dealing with an outsourced TPL recovery. You'll see under OHC recovery fees, assuming 12% at 742.
Oh, okay.
Up line 22.
$742,000. That's what it would be per year, correct?
No, but then we go down and the reduction in TPL fees, we'd reduce that number by $371,000.
How do you do that?
Line, reduction in TPL fees, line 37.
I got it. But I mean, how do you reduce that?
Because our cost would be less than what the average TPL recovery unit would be spending right now.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, just if your numbers are 418,000 people are in Oregon.
481, 418, yeah.
Or whatever it was. I did that times 75 cents a month times 12, and I came up with $3,762,000 a year.
$3,700,000.
Right. Well, monthly, we're talking on a monthly annual basis.
Yeah,
for the fees being
right.
Correct.
So where is that in here?
You know, I did not produce this Excel spreadsheet, and I know it's done based on other providers. So it is.
But this says Oregon.
$313,500 a month.
These numbers are taken off your CMS 64, which is what Medicaid has to file with the federal government on their cost avoidance and cost recoveries. So these are Oregon's public information numbers.
But if you're giving us the figure, we need your number.
Yes, I cannot break that number out of here for you today. It's just my lack of knowledge on the way that this spreadsheet was set up. My apologies for that. I can get back to you on how that was done. But I think for Oregon, it is not as specific because you do handle your TPL recoveries in-house.
And just for the committee, this bill would have a referral to Ways and Means simply because that does fit into the budget. So
it seems like a lot cheaper though than they're trying to
right.
start up a program.
Right, right. So, but they will need to factor that into the agency budget for outsourcing. So.
Mm-hmm. Have you thought about contracts in which payment is contingent on savings actually being realized in the state?
Excellent question. Chair Cruz, Representative Mona Sanderson. We have. We have looked into various ways. The one that we are very excited about now is for the first one or two states or three states that come on initially. We have an indemnifier that will issue a bond, that not a taxing bond, but a bond to insure you that if we do not perform to the level that we have projected, I think in our specific contract, if we do not double your current collections, you will return complete return of fees.
We would be one of the first states.
Nope, nobody likes to be first.
Yeah, that.
I never heard that one before. So. Yes, we have a wonderful way to bring your comfort level up to where you'd like it.
Actually, Oregon
would actually be the first state, right?
Mm-hmm. Not necessarily. It depends.
Right,
you know, there's a lot of people moving forward on this.
Yeah.
I'm just not involved with all of them.
Any other questions? I said we will be revisiting this issue once the bill is cut. So, gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm close the informational meeting, and we are adjourned.
No,
we are not adjourned. Excuse me. I take back the adjournment. We are recessed till 1:30.
I was even writing.
I know you weren't picking up.